Thank you very much, Bill. It alarms me to realize that you heard me speak before, even in 1962, because I doubt that I'm saying anything different than I said then, and in some ways I hope not. Most people that have heard me don't come back, so I don't have to worry about repeating myself. This time I have a problem. All the references to United Parcel and the post office reminded me of an experience that Henry Manny told me about down at his institute in Miami. He had some material he desperately needed for a meeting, so he got Federal Express, not trusting the post office, and they failed him. And the ironic thing was that the head of Federal Express was at the meeting and was the one that needed the material. I think the post office gets a certain amount of criticism, which may not be entirely fair. You heard it suggested, I think, as I have, that the way to slow down inflation would be to turn it over to the post office. a statistician friend of mine pointed out that they're accused unfairly of having inflated the rates. That used to be they charged a nickel and delivered the letter in a day, and now it's 13 cents and they take 3 days, and that's less than 5 cents a day. So so much for the post office and the and overregulation. A couple of months ago, at the time of Lincoln's birthday, I was asked to give a speech in connection with Lincoln's birthday, and they suggested it would be nice to say something, make some mention of Lincoln's name in the course of it. That led me to look up some things to see what was mentionable about his activities in the present context, and one of the things that I came across and was particularly interested in was Lincoln's ideas on how to get rid of slavery. They seem to be ideas that would be very appropriate today, and it's too bad people don't keep track of them. He proposed that very soon after taking office, he proposed that the federal government buy the slaves and turn them loose, or nationalize them, as I suppose we'd say in today's language, and free them. That wasn't entirely original with him. That's what the British did do in the Caribbean and other territories of theirs where there was slavery. He had a number of arguments for this. The first ones, maybe the ones that motivated him most strongly, are not of particular interest for our subject today. One was that he told the congressmen that if they'd look up the treasury figures and the census figures, they'd see that what it was costing to run that war would buy all the slaves state by state and save a lot of money. Another argument he made, which I think is the one he weighed most heavily because he repeated it all during the war. He kept working away at this right up till late 64, trying to persuade the South to sell or the North to buy. He pointed out that he thought the border states would accept the offer, and that if they accepted the offer, the Confederate states, which he didn't call that, he had some derogatory name for them, but if the rebellious states, I guess it was, they would be convinced that they could never get the border states to join them, even if they were to win the war, and that in the face of that prospect, they would give up on the war. But finally, in one of his talks, he came across the passage that I think is particularly relevant for the subject today, and I want to just read that part. He says, in a certain sense, the liberation of slaves is the destruction of property. Property acquired by descent or by purchase, the same as any other property. It is no less true, for having been often said, that the people of the South are not more responsible for the original introduction of this property than are the people of the North. And when it is remembered how unhesitatingly we all use cotton and sugar and share the profits of dealing in them, it may not be safe to say that the South has been more responsible than the North for its continuance. And then a key sentence, if then, for a common object, this property is to be sacrificed, is it not just that it be done at a common charge? As if the property is to be sacrificed, shouldn't it be done at a common charge? Now, the Constitution would say yes to that. It does have some things to say about seizing property without compensation, all negative and unfriendly to that idea. And we in general would say today that if the government, let's say, decides to take your land for a national park or some other purpose, they'll, or a highway, they'll pay you for it. And that's true in a way. If they take the whole piece of property, if they take the title to your real estate and have it transferred to you, to them, they will compensate you on some basis. But when you ask what's really meant by property, property is an abstract concept. It's not a piece of real estate or an automobile or a book or whatever it may be. It's the bundle of rights and obligations that go, that you have. That is, when you own a piece of real estate, that means that there are certain rights you have about excluding other people from its use or using it yourself in certain ways, and there are certain limitations you have about not being able to use it in certain ways, and the property right is that bundle. And what the government is doing is not stripping away the title, just stripping away some of the rights gradually, but it has the same effect. In California now, there are some lots. I have a friend who happens, unfortunately, to have bought one shortly before this law went into effect, where it's illegal to build a house over 3 feet high. And he was rather incensed, and he felt the state should buy the lot from him. And that's what I would say, too, and that's what Lincoln said, so we have good authority on it. Now, of course, they didn't really write a law saying you can't build a house over 3 feet high. They wrote a law saying something to the effect that you can't build a house that'll interfere with the view of the ocean from the highway. And he just happened to have a lot where any house over 3 feet high would do that. Of course, there are other lots where you could build your house 20 feet high. But increasingly, they impose these, they strip away rights you thought you had. If you had an automobile, you bought it thinking you can go 65 miles an hour, now they strip that right away and you can only go 55. That may not be a very great commercial value, but nevertheless, and maybe they should have paid you for it. At any rate, that process is going on in a growing way, and certain parts of the economy are much more accessible targets for that kind of activity than others. I think myself that this kind of thing is a major factor in the poor performance of the stock market, and is why I don't expect to see it turning up in the visible future, though now that I said that, I hope it will, for a variety of reasons. That is to say that the kinds of rights that are signified by stock certificates are just the kind the government can get at and strip away, or where they can add additional burdens. And you'll notice that a number of things are skyrocketing in value. Postage stamps, antiques, works of art, things that the government can't very easily get its hands on are going up very rapidly. And a lot of the uncertainty in the economy that the administration complains about is due to this kind of thing, that you're in the timber business and you go out and put out some of these one-inch seedlings that you can harvest, or somebody can harvest in 75 years, a good chance that long before that somebody will have taken it away from you or prohibited cutting timber or something of this sort. It'll introduce a lot of uncertainty in many other areas. There have been great uncertainties. The data on capital investment for this stage of a recovery, stage of economic expansion, show that it's lagging quite badly, but when you break it down, which I haven't, but which those who have tell me what you find when you break it down, is that investments that have a relatively short payoff period, ones that will pay off within 5 years, are right up to snuff, right where they are, and usually in this stage of expansion. Those with a long payoff, 10 years or more, are seriously lagging. That is, that's where all the shortage is. And of course, that signifies that 10 to 20 years into the future, there will be very, very serious shortages of the goods and services that keep people fed and heated and housed and transported and cured of their illnesses or prevented from it and so on. That is to say, it has ominous indications for the actual level of welfare of the people living in the country 10 to 15 years in the future. Now, how does all this come about? I could spell out a lot more of this kind of thing when I talk about an overgoverned society, which incidentally is a phrase from Walter Lippmann, who talked about the sickness of an overgoverned society, and all of the and that was in the late 30s that he used that phrase in his book called The Good Society. We were talking at the lunch table about some of the regulations of universities, in particular the one that says that if a student is mentally handicapped, an applicant for admission is mentally handicapped, he must be admitted if he would be admissible if he weren't mentally handicapped. Well, you think I'm joking, but go look up the law. It's exactly what it says. And it goes ahead to say, and having admitted him, you must do whatever is necessary to see that he gets the same benefits from the education that he would have gotten if he hadn't been mentally handicapped. And now those laws are coming, regulations are coming forth at the rate of 30,000 or 40,000 pages of small print per year currently, which is what I'm referring to by an overregulated society. But how do we get into this? In the first place, I would describe it as a perversion of the rule of law. That is, by the phrase the rule of law, we've had certain simple general propositions in mind that date all the way back to Magna Carta about due process and no ex post facto legislation, no bills of attainder. Well, that doesn't go back to Magna Carta, but to the first 10 amendments. Right to present testimony, to hear witnesses against you, to trial by jury, and so on. We have certain general procedural matters that we refer to as rule of law. The rule of law, the phrase the rule of law now is coming, the content of it is coming to be that everything will be ruled by law. It's a reversion to the meaning of the phrase in the Middle Ages, that it's inappropriate for anything, almost anything, not to be ruled by law, so that it's moving from it's moving from the rule of law to the rule of lawyers, or to the notion that anything that isn't prohibited ought to be compulsory, and if it isn't compulsory, it ought to be prohibited. That is, this is a slight caricature, but certainly moving very rapidly in that direction. And this perversion of the rule of law, inversion of its meaning, really, has come about largely through another inversion, and that is the protection of the rights of minorities. As we talk about a country of majority rule, that's not what we have. We have rule by minorities. The people who wrote the Constitution used a lot of ingenuity to try to set up a government that would be representative of and responsive to the whole people, and yet would protect the rights of minorities. And that's a no mean trick, because once you let the majority rule, they don't really care about people that have wrong views having free speech, or if they're wicked, keeping their property, or various other, most of the things spelled out in the Bill of Rights are there to keep the majority from ruling in those respects, to protect the rights of minorities. But gradually, as Dicey pointed out 65 years ago, we've come under the tyranny of minorities as they've learned to manipulate parliamentary democracies. If you look at a congressman who is interested in being reelected, and that's fewer of them than it used to be, but it's still an overwhelming majority, they have to work at it all the time, because they run every 2 years. And if most congressmen win by something in the order of 5 to 10%, now that's a change too. It used to be most of them won by less than 5%, but increasingly the incumbents are winning re-election, and increasingly they're winning it by bigger and bigger majorities. But nevertheless, 60% and up is high. So if you have a congressman like that, and there's a block of people in his constituency that care so much about one issue, whether it's a culvert in their neighborhood or whatever it is, that they're going to vote for or against him, that is one issue voters that are going to vote for or against him on that issue, he has to try to get it for them. And frankly, it doesn't matter whether he does or not, and he'll see that. Because if he doesn't, the man they elect to replace him next time will work at it. He will figure in the House that he's one of 435, so his vote it's very unlikely it will be the one that determines the outcome. Why should he cast a vote that causes him to be defeated when it won't cause the decision that's in the interest of the public to come through? And if he did, as I say, he could expect to be replaced the next time. And even if he's in the 60-65% range, he can't afford to lose very many. Every time he loses a block of 3 to 5 or 8%, he's put himself at hazard for the next election. Now, when a group of congressmen come together in a new Congress that have been elected this way, they of course have not all been elected by the same blocks. They have not satisfied the same groups of minorities, and there's no law they could possibly pass. They couldn't get a majority for anything when they first come together. And the job of a congressman, it's a very difficult job, and it takes a very high order of skill and ability, is to put together coalitions so that things that his constituents want will pass, and preferably without passing things that are too obnoxious to his constituents. That is, if Proposition A is the one he has to get enacted, he has to find a Proposition B whose supporters don't think A is obnoxious, or not so much as to wipe out the benefit of getting B, and where B, again, is not too obnoxious to the supporters of A. And usually the A and B together aren't enough either. He's got to get a C and a D and an E and an F and maybe a G and an H all to come together. This accounts for some of the heterogeneous bill legislation you get. And that means he has to look down the pike. That is, if he signs up with B to start with, that may make it impossible to get C, D, E, and F. So until he knows whether he can get C, D, E, and F, he won't go for B. So it's not a trivial and not an easy job, and while theoretically mathematicians can analyze it by linear programming and so on, and in the way Congress actually works, it can't be done that way. And whatever's wrong with congressmen mostly isn't stupidity. Some of them it is, but for the most part that's not the case, no matter how stupid the things they're doing may seem. So that we have a tyranny of minorities. When a Congress like that adjourns, you can be sure that if you just wipe out every bit of legislation they passed, everybody would be better off. But of course you can't do that. They might wipe out my particular pet project, but I couldn't be sure they'd wipe out yours, so I'd rather stick with mine. And even though the net effect of yours and everybody else's more than offsets to me the advantage of mine, there's no way for me to make that trade in the present political system. And I think that look at the political system is the most discouraging thing when you look ahead. Public opinion polls suggest that somewhere around 70 to 80% of the public is now greatly alarmed and concerned and distressed about over-government. And in the last presidential election, you notice both the candidates, even the President of the United States, ran against the government. It's the only way to get elected, apparently, is to, and congressmen all run against Congress. The public is overwhelmingly distressed at this, but if you look at the actual mechanism, it's hard to see how that will make any difference at all. And the fact is that the movement toward over-government is accelerating. In the first 2 years of the Carter administration, having been elected on an anti-government platform, there will have been about a 5% increase in the number of regulators in the 30 major regulatory agencies. About 10,000 will have been added to the 205,000 that were already there in those agencies within that two-year period, which is much more than the growth of the rest of government employment. Now, I don't see how, with the political system, you can defeat that no matter what the majority wants. That is, that it is ruled by minorities. And note that I put the plural, not by a minority. Now, one of the consequences of Congress is elected this way is that they literally cannot cope with any issue of any importance, of any national significance. They can't cope with energy policy. They can't possibly formulate a good defense policy. They can't formulate a foreign policy or an employment policy, or an anti-inflation policy, or anything, whatever it is. There's no way a Congress like that can cope with it because it's impossible for them to operate on principle. That is, their operations have to be calculated on the basis of putting these coalitions together. And principle has nothing to do with that. And when they can't act on principle, they have a couple of corollaries follow that are very disadvantageous. They can't act with any consistency. They'll pass a bill this week which has one set of effects, and next week one with the opposite. In fact, they'll pass a bill in which two different chapters have opposite effects. They lack consistency, and they lack stability in time. They will pass something this year. Well, look at the Social Security law. Late in the last session, they raised the Social Security taxes way beyond anything that was made any sense in terms of Social Security, unless they just wanted money to run the Treasury with. And now they propose to cut them back again, except they aren't doing it that directly and that deliberately. They'll do it in some circuitous way. They'll be worse than if they cut them directly or hadn't raised them that much. So they have neither consistency nor stability. Now, in the face of this, with Congress simply defaulting on all the major issues for generations, gradually the courts have moved in the picture. It's easy to say the courts are power hungry and they grab, and I think they are and they do, but that isn't the whole story. And anyway, you have to explain how they got that way, what started it. They didn't used to be nearly so much that way 100 years ago or so. And I think the defaults, the persistent defaults, account for it. Take something like apportionment of legislatures and Congress. That was everybody knew there wasn't even the remotest attempt to have that conform to what the Constitution said, and that went on for generations, and the Supreme Court repeatedly refused to hear cases like that. They would admit that it's terrible and doesn't conform to the Constitution, but they kept saying that lies within the powers of Congress to remedy. It's not within our power to remedy it. But finally, they saw the light, or whatever, down the tunnel, and moved into that. And as some of the people earlier in the earlier decisions and the dissenters in that case predicted, there's no end of it. That is, they first say what you did isn't consistent with constitutional principles, so go back and do it consistently with constitutional principles. And pretty soon someone comes in and they say, sometimes with some prodding from objectors, well, that doesn't meet the requirements. And pretty soon they start specifying formulas like that the biggest difference can't be over 15% between the most population and the least in a district. And finally, they just say, gee, bring us a map and a pencil. And they start doing it. If you take the criminal situation, the abuse of criminals in the third degree and mistreatment in prison and so on, that was a standard device in the movies and the stage and in novels and common news, commonplace. Everybody knew that happened. Nobody doubted it. Nobody did anything about it. Finally, they began moving to try to stop some of the worst abuses. But once they started, there's nowhere to stop. And they're running the prisons and running the criminal system and doing the day-to-day direct administration. On the racial segregation, the same thing, that eventually public opinion had finally moved in the direction of opposing some of the race discrimination, or a good part of it, especially where it was perpetrated by the government with government facilities. And finally, the court in 54 reversed their 1893 decision and said, if it's separate, it isn't equal. And that seemed well and good. But now they're running school systems. Some judges have actually got school boards, in effect, de facto school boards, attached to them, advisory councils, telling them how to run the schools. And they're meeting every day to consult with these people and so on. That is, once the courts do get in, they don't know where to stop. And there isn't anywhere to stop, really. I wouldn't be able to tell them either. And that was the real reason for not starting. Recognizing that however meritorious the initial cause, the means of dealing with it would in the end create far worse problems than they would cure. But nevertheless, we are down that, well down that path, and toward rule by government by judiciary. And that, the only limitation there is that so far the courts haven't really got any way to get money. They have passed orders that various jurisdictions should use money in certain ways, and even that they should raise money in certain ways. But some of them have declined, most of them have done that so far. We have a case now in Cleveland where the city voters just plain refused to do what the courts told them to do. And that the judge there is now conferring with the legislators to see what they think of doing, and if they don't think of the right thing, he's going to order them to do what he thinks is the right thing. And this has all the seeds of a constitutional crisis, and if it doesn't arise there, it'll arise in some issue like that. And they'll be in the position of Andrew Jackson, who said, the courts made its decision, let's see them enforce it. Well, somebody's going to say, the courts made its decision, let's see them finance it. And I don't know whether that'll be serious or whether it'll blow over and be smoothed out. It's hard to say. It'll depend a great deal on the circumstances. Well, if you ask how could this possibly be prevented or reversed, Again, the only way of reversing it is through the political process I described earlier. The people who wrote the Constitution anticipated all this. If you read their propaganda, particularly in the Federalist Papers, everything that's happened they foresaw, except they put in methods of stopping it. One of the things they did was itemize a few things that the federal government can do and say nothing else. But of course, if you write a list like that so it's workable, it's got a certain amount of flexibility and is subject to interpretation. And for the first 100 years or so, a lot of people date it down to the Munn versus Illinois case in 1870. Up to that point, they seem more or less to adhere to the provisions in the Constitution. But there's another aspect of the situation that I think is significant. In the Constitution, well, if you read the Federalist Papers, they have one absolutely incredible claim, boast, to try to persuade the voters to adopt it. And that is, they say, we've got this thing rigged so that the people can't get at it. We've set up a government that will be representative and responsive, but there won't be any way for the people to get at it. Now, I'd like to see you sell something today on that basis. They pointed out that the House of Representatives was the only part of the government that the public would be, the voters would be allowed to vote for. And because they come with such poor credentials, they won't let them stay but 2 years. The senators would be elected by the state legislatures, and they said state legislators know what the issues are that'll be faced by the government. They know what the abilities are that'll be required, what kind of temperament. They'll probably be personally acquainted with the candidates, and they probably have a good chance of picking some people to make good senators. And once they're picked, to keep those legislators from tampering with them, we'll put them in there for 6 years so that they're not subject to, except maybe in the last year or so, to pressures for re-election. And of course, the president and vice president were elected by an electoral college, elected for the specific purpose of electing the president and vice president, and the judges are appointed by the president and the Senate. So nobody was elected except the House. Now everybody's elected except the judges. They have permanent tenure, more permanent even than in the universities, lifetime tenure. And not only that, their salaries can't be cut during that time. They are the only people chosen as originally provided in the Constitution, and there are some advantages that follow from that. For example, they can act on principle because it's a hierarchical structure. The Supreme Court can hammer out a principle, and all the other courts have to fall in line. The issues for the other courts are just how does this principle apply to this case, or which principle applies to this case. But the principle is established on top. And acting on principle, they can have a fair degree of consistency from one case to another, and they do. And they can also have a great deal of stability in time. I mentioned the segregation case that was reversed from 1893, was reversed in 54. Well, that's fairly unusual, even with that long a time gap. Once in a while, you hear of a decision that's reversed in a matter of 3 or 4 years, and that's big news. Any reversal is big news, because in general, they're stable and consistent. So they have some real advantages there. The one thing that really keeps them from taking over the government is, as I say, their inability to get funds. Now, all of this seems to me basically to be rooted in public opinion, that there's no use trying to educate congressmen because they are dependent for re-election on public opinion. And the public opinion in these matters has been moving in this direction for a century. More strongly abroad than here, but it was moving this way here a century ago, and by the end of the First World War, with a tide of opinion among what you'd call the academic journalistic complex, was moving very strongly in that direction. There may be some tendency to reversal, but it seems to me that any, I don't know whether there is or not, that's a terribly hard thing to judge. And there are people, most people seem to think there is some tendency. Certainly nothing could reverse in less than a couple of generations, even if we had a major change in public opinion. So I find it hard to, with a group like this that I assume is realistic and hard-headed, I find it hard to get up and say, and to say as I sit down, I'm really optimistic. Everything's going to turn around. We're going to go back to a free society. We might. And I know that for generations, the older generation, which I'm a member of now, are always saying things are going to the dogs. And the trouble is, when you look back for a while, it appears maybe they really have.